From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
So there's different kinds of occupation now by this capitalist machine. You have Afghanistan and Iraq occupied militarily, but you have countries like India which are being taken over by a sort of checkbook diplomacy. And now we have almost civil war breaking out there, which is very, very serious.
Today, we spend the hour with acclaimed author and activist Arundhati Roy on India, globalization, and war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In its annual report on human rights, Amnesty International has slammed the Bush administration for holding prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and at secret black sites across the globe. The group called for Guantanamo to be shut down. Amnesty Secretary General Irene Khan said, quote, Guantanamo prison camp is an aberration under international law. It places people outside the rule of law, and it sends a message to other regimes around the world, like Egypt or China, that they too can ignore human rights. The group said the U.S.-led war against terrorism has sparked a rise in human rights abuses as countries turn a blind eye to violations by their allies. It also accused U.N. Security Council members, Russia and China, of consistently flouting human rights in pursuit of their own agendas. On the issue of Sudan, Amnesty called on the United Nations to take a more active role in addressing the abuses occurring in Darfur. Court-martial proceedings have begun for an Army sergeant accused of using military dogs to threaten detainees at Abu Ghraib. The trial of Sergeant Santos Cardona may expose who within the Pentagon's chain of command ordered soldiers to abuse and torture detainees at the Iraq prison. For the first time, Major General Jeffrey Miller is expected to testify about what happened at the prison. Until now, Miller has refused to publicly speak about his role overseeing interrogations at Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo. Meanwhile, it's now been revealed that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld directly communicated with Miller and other senior defense officials by video teleconference about interrogation matters in November and December of 2003, at the time when the worst abuses were taking place at Abu Ghraib. Lawyers for Sergeant Cardona are attempting to obtain copies of these video conferences to use as part of their defense. This news from Burma. A top UN official is reporting that jailed pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi remains in good spirits and still wants to make a contribution to society. On Saturday, the official, Ibrahim Gambari, became the first foreigner to meet with Suu Kyi since she was put under house arrest in 2003. She leads Burma's National League for Democracy. The group won a landslide election victory in 1990, but the military refused to hand over power. For the past 3 years, Aung San Suu Kyi has been held in near complete isolation from the outside world. Her phone has been cut off, and she's barred from having visitors except for a doctor and a maid. This week, the generals who crushed Suu Kyi's democracy movement are expected to decide whether to extend her house arrest beyond its present term, which expires on Saturday. In news from Israel, British Attorney General Lord Peter Goldsmith is expected to meet with senior Israeli officials Thursday. Goldsmith plans to discuss whether war crimes charges should be filed against the Israeli soldiers who shot and killed the British filmmaker James Miller and the British peace activist Tom Herndl. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have captured the leader of the military wing of Hamas in the West Bank in a raid in Ramallah. The Israeli government has accused the man, Ibrahim Hamad, of masterminding a string of suicide bombings. In Washington, the House is scheduled to vote today to ban direct U.S. economic assistance to the Palestinian government and restrict money to private aid groups that operate in Gaza and the West Bank. The bill is expected to be overwhelmingly approved, even though it does not have the support of the White House. According to the Knight Ridder News Agency, the U.S. would only be allowed to provide limited humanitarian assistance to Palestinians through non-governmental organizations. Assistance beyond food, water, medicine, and sanitation would require a presidential waiver. Leading the lobbying effort for the bill has been AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. AIPAC has been accused of threatening lawmakers who oppose the legislation. Democratic Congresswoman Betty McCollum of Minnesota said an AIPAC activist warned her chief of staff that her, quote, support for terrorists will not be tolerated. McCollum said she's no longer allowing representatives from AIPAC in her office or to meet with her staff. McCollum has said she opposes the bill because it could destabilize the situation and heighten chances of a humanitarian crisis. President Bush warned Monday that Venezuela and Bolivia are suffering from what he described as a, quote, erosion of democracy. Bush's comments come a week after the U.S. cut off military sales to Venezuela and 3 weeks after Bolivia announced it would nationalize its natural gas resources. Bush said he had a message for Venezuela, Bolivia, and other nations in the hemisphere.
I am going to continue to remind our hemisphere that respect for property rights and human rights is essential for all countries in order for there to be prosperity and peace. I'm going to remind our allies and friends in the neighborhood that the United States of America stands for justice, that when we see poverty, we care about it and we do something about it, that we care for good, we stand for good health care. I'm going to remind our people that meddling in other elections is to achieve a short-term objective is not in the interest of the neighborhood.
In media news, a national coalition of community media organizations is organizing a day of action to save public access television and protect net neutrality. Protests are planned Wednesday in New York City, Chicago, Boston, San Francisco. Protest organizers are calling on Congress to reject the COPE bill, which would effectively end what is known as net neutrality, the concept that internet users should be able to access any web contact with restrictions or limitations imposed by their internet service provider. Another provision of the bill would cut back the obligation of cable TV companies to devote channels to public access and fund the facilities to run them. Meanwhile, a group of major telecoms, including AT&T and Bell South, have launched a counter-campaign to attack the concept of net neutrality. The group has hired President Clinton's former spokesperson, Mike McCurry. It's also begun taking out ads on progressive websites, urging readers to, quote, say no to government regulation of the internet. In other media news, a group of investors led by a public relations executive with ties to the Republican Party appears to be on the verge of buying both daily newspapers in Philadelphia, The Inquirer, and The Daily News. The former Knight Ridder newspapers were bought by the McClatchy newspaper chain in March and then put up for resale. The Newspaper Guild Union also put up a bid to buy the papers in an effort to keep Philadelphia as a two-paper city. Many fear the new owners will decide to close The Daily News. And U.S. immigration officials have blocked the Sri Lankan music star known as MIA from entering the country to visit or work. The artist wrote a message to her fans online saying, quote, I'm locked out. They won't let me in. Now I'm strictly making my album outside the borders. MIA was born in Britain but raised in Sri Lanka, where her father was a founding member of the militant Tamil Tigers. Earlier this year, the editors of The Village Voice named her debut record the second best recording of 2005. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we spend the hour with acclaimed author and activist Arundhati Roy. Her first novel, The God of Small Things, was awarded the Booker Prize in 1997. It's sold over 6 million copies, has been translated in over 20 languages around the world. Since then, Arundhati Roy has devoted herself to political writing and activism. In India, she's involved in the movement opposing hydroelectric dam projects that have displaced thousands of people. In 2002, she was convicted of contempt of court in New Delhi for accusing the court of attempting to silence protests against the Narmada Dam project. She received a symbolic one-day prison sentence. She's also been a vocal opponent of the Indian government's nuclear weapons program, as she is of all nuclear programs around the world. Arundhati Roy has also become known across the globe for her powerful political essays in books like Power Politics, War Talk, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, and her latest, An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire. In June of 2005, she served as chair of the Jury of Conscience at the World Tribunal on Iraq in Istanbul. She joins us today in our Firehouse studio for the hour here in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. What does it feel to be back in the United States? A different perspective on the world from here.
Well, I think the last time I was here was just before the elections, you know, when we were hoping that Bush wouldn't come back. But the point was that whoever came back seemed to have been supporting the war on Iraq in some way. So there was a crisis of democracy here as much as anywhere else in the world. I think, you know, when you don't come to the United States often from the outside, the most important thing is that it's easy for us to forget that there is dissent within this country against the system that its government stands for. And it's important and heartening for me to remind myself of that, because outside there's so much anger against America, and obviously, you know, that confusion between people and governments and exists, and it was enhanced when Bush was voted back to power. You know, people started saying, is there a difference?
Well, of course, the way you see America and Americans outside the United States is through the media. It's
exactly.
Projected through. Which channels do you access in India? What do you get to see? And what do you think of how the media deals with these issues?
Well, in India, I think you get Fox News and CNN and, of course, the BBC. Also, a lot of newspapers in India do publish American columnists, famously Thomas Friedman. And of course, recently George Bush visited India, which was a humiliating and very funny episode at the same time. You know, what happened to him there and how he came and how the media reacted.
I want to get your reaction to that visit. And actually, first, though, play a clip of President Bush when he went to India in March. He promised to increase economic integration with the U.S. and signed an agreement to foster nuclear cooperation between the two countries.
We concluded an historic agreement today on nuclear power. It's not an easy job for the Prime Minister to achieve this agreement. I understand. It's not easy for the American president to achieve this agreement, but it's a necessary agreement. It's one that'll help both our peoples.
President Bush in India.
Well, the strange thing was that before he came, they wanted him to address a joint House of Parliament, but some members of Parliament said that they would heckle him and that, you know, it would be embarrassing for him to come there. So then they thought they would ask him to address a public meeting at the Red Fort, which is in Old Delhi, which is where the Prime Minister of India always gives his Independence Day speech from. But that was considered unsafe because Old Delhi is full of Muslims, and you know how they think of all Muslims as terrorists. So then they thought, okay, we'll do it in Vigyan Bhavan, which is a sort of state auditorium, but that was considered too much of a come down for the US president. So funnily enough, they eventually settled on him speaking in Purana Qila, which is the old fort which houses the Delhi Zoo. And it was really from there that and of course it wasn't a public meeting. It was the caged animals and some caged CEOs that he addressed. And then he went to Hyderabad, and I think he met a buffalo there, some special kind of buffalo, because there was a paper of Bush and the buffalo in all the papers. But the point is that insulated from the public, there were massive demonstrations where hundreds of thousands of people showed up, but it didn't seem to matter either to Bush or to the Indian government, which went ahead and signed deals where this kind of embrace between a poorer country or a developing country in America, we have such a litany of the history of incineration when you embrace the government of the United States. And that's what happened, that the Indian government in full servile mode has entered into this embrace, has negotiated itself into a corner, and now continues to do this deadly sort of dance. But I must say that while Bush was in Delhi, at the same time, on the streets apart from the protests, there were 60 widows that had come from Kerala, which is the south of India, which is where I come from. And they had come to Delhi because they were 60 out of the tens of thousands of widows of farmers who've committed suicide because they've been encircled by debt. And this is a fact that's simply not reported, partly because there are no official figures, partly because the Indian government quibbles about what constitutes suicide and what is a farmer. Like if a man commits suicide but the land is in his old father's name, he doesn't count. If it's a woman, she doesn't count because women can't be farmers.
So she counts as someone who committed suicide but not as a farmer who committed
suicide.
Tens of thousands?
Tens of thousands. And then, anyway, so these 60 women were there on the street. Asking the Indian government to write off the debts of their husbands, right? Across the street from them, in a five-star hotel, were Bush's 16 sniffer dogs who were staying in this five-star hotel. And we were all told that you can't call them dogs because they're actually officers of the American army. You know, I don't know what the names were, Sergeant Pepper and Corporal whatever. And so it was, you know, it wasn't even possible to be satirical or write black comedy because it was all real. And
President Bush visit Gandhi's grave?
He visited Gandhi's grave, and first his dogs visited Gandhi's grave, then, you know, Gandhians were like wanting to purify it. And I said, look, I don't mind the dogs. I mind Bush much more than the dogs, you know. But Gandhi, obviously one can have all kinds of opinions about Gandhi. It's not universal that everybody adores and loves him. But still, he stood for non-violence. And here it was really the equivalent of a butcher coming there and tipping a pot of blood on that memorial and going away. There was no room left, as I said, for satire or for anything because it was so vulgar, the whole of it. But I have to say, the Indian mainstream media was so servile. You know, you had a newspaper like the Indian Express saying, he is here and he has spoken. I'm sure he doesn't get worshipped that much even by the American mainstream press, you know. It was extraordinary.
Let me play another clip of President Bush. I think in this one he's talking about trade in India.
The markets are open. And the poor are given a chance to develop their talents and abilities. They can create a better life for their families. They add to the wealth of the world, and they can begin to afford goods and services from other nations. Free and fair trade, it's good for India, it's good for America, and it is good for the world. In my countries, some focus only on one aspect of our trade relationship with India, outsourcing. It's true that some Americans have lost jobs when their companies moved operations overseas. It's also important to remember that when someone loses a job, it's an incredibly difficult period for the worker and their families. Some people believe the answer to this problem is to wall off our economy from the world through protectionist policies. I strongly disagree.
President Bush speaking in India. Arundhati Roy, your response.
Well, look, let's not forget that this whole call to the free market started in the late 19th century in India. You know, that was what colonialism was all about. They kept using the words free market, and we know how free the free market is. Today, India has, I mean, after 15 years of economic liberalization, we have more than half of the world's malnutrition children. We have an economy where the differences between the rich and the poor, which have always been huge, has increased enormously. We have a feudal society whose feudalism has just been reinforced by all of this. And, you know, it's amazing. If you, just in the wake of Bush's visit, you can't imagine what's happening, say, in a city like Delhi. You can't imagine the open aggression of institutions of our democracy is really like courts, for instance, who are an old enemy of mine, are rolling up their sleeves and coming after us. You have in Delhi, for example, I've just come from watching, from being on the streets for 6 weeks where all kinds of protests are taking place. But you have a city that's been just, it's just turned into a city of bulldozers and policemen. Overnight, notices go up saying tomorrow or day after tomorrow, you are going to be evicted from here. The Supreme Court judges have come out saying things like, if the poor can't afford to live in the city, why do they come here? And you, basically, behind it all, there are two facades. One is that in 2008, Delhi is going to host the Commonwealth Games. For this, hundreds of thousands of people are being driven out of the city. But the real agenda is, it came in the wake of Bush's visit, which is that the city is being prepared for foreign direct investment in retail, which means Walmart and Kmart and all these people are going to come in, which means that this city of millions of pavement dwellers, hawkers, fruit sellers, people who have, it's a city that's grown up over centuries and centuries. It's just being cleaned out under the guise of sort of legal action. And at the same time, people from villages are being driven out of their villages because of the corporatization of agriculture, because of these big development projects. So you have an institution like, you know, I mean, how do you subvert democracy? We have a parliament, sure, we have elections, sure, but we have a Supreme Court now that micromanages our lives. It takes every decision. What should be in history books? Should this slum be cleared? Should this road be widened? What gas should we use? Every single decision is now taken by a court. You can't criticize the court. If you do, you go to jail, like I did. So you have judges who are, you have to read those judgments to believe it. You know, public interest litigation has become a weapon that judges use against us. So for example, a former Chief Justice of India, he gave a decision allowing the Narmada Dam to be built where 400,000 people will be displaced. He gave, the same judge gave a judgment saying slum dwellers are pickpockets of urban land. So you displace people from the villages, they come into the cities, you call them pickpockets. He gave a judgment shutting down all kinds of informal industry in Delhi. Then he gave a judgment asking for all India's rivers to be linked, which is a Stalinist scheme beyond imagination, where millions of people will be displaced. And when he retired, he joined Coca-Cola. You know, it's incredible.
Arundhati Roy is our guest for the hour. We'll be back with her in a minute.
Yeah, we got God down, we got you. Every day thinking about how we get through. Everything I own is on I owe you. But I'm here bringing y'all something new. You know, like the people, then they like you. Then they're gonna set it off with the big boo. Son in the battle, it's a son and daughter too. What you wanna talk about? Who done who? What you wanna talk about? Slang time, that's that in my A thing. I got the bombs to make you blow. I got the beats to make you bang. Slang time, that's that in my A thing. I got the bombs to make you blow. I got the beats to make you bang. Pull out the people, pull out the poor. 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 Pull out the poor, pull out the poor. I'm a fighter, fighter God. I'm a soldier on that road. I'm a fighter, nice, nice fighter. I'm a soldier on that road.
MIA, pull up the people. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 420 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations and NPR stations, on college and community radio stations and low-power FM stations, also on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Tell your friends. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest today for the hour is Arundhati Roy. She just recently flown in from New Delhi, India. She is the author of a number of books. Her Booker Prize award-winning book, The God of Small Things, and then her books of essays, The Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire, The Checkbook and the Cruise Missile, among them. Arundhati, you were just talking about what is happening in India. Thomas Friedman, the well-known, much-read New York Times columnist and author, talks about the call center being a perfect symbol of globalization in a very positive sense.
Yeah, it is the perfect symbol, I think, in many ways. I wish Friedman would spend some time working in one. But I think it's a very interesting issue, the call center, because, you know, let's not get into the psychosis that takes place inside a call center. The fact that you have people working, you know, according to a different body clock and all that, and the languages, and the fact that you have to de-identify yourself.
And just for people who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, the call center being places where, well, you might make a call to information or to some corporation, you actually are making that call to India, and someone in a call center is picking it up.
But you know, the thing is that it's a good example of what's going on. The call center is surely creating jobs for a whole lot of people in India. But it comes as part of a package. And that package, while it gives sort of an English-speaking middle or low middle-class young person a job for a while, they can never last because it's such a hard job. It actually is also part of the corporate culture, which is taking away land and resources and water from millions of rural people. So, but you're giving the more vocal and the better off anyway, the people who speak even a little bit of English are the better off among the millions of people in India. So, to give these people jobs, you're taking away the livelihoods of millions of others. And this is what globalization does. It creates, obviously, it creates a very vocal constituency that supports it among the elite of poor countries. And so you have in India an elite, an upper caste, upper class, wealthy elite who are fiercely loyal to the neoliberal program. It isn't that. And that's exactly, obviously, what colonialism has always done. And it's exactly what happened in countries in Latin America. But now it's happening in India, and the rhetoric of democracy is in place because they've learned how to hollow out democracy and make it lose meaning. All it means, it seems, is elections, where whoever you vote for, they're going to do the same thing.
You mentioned the dams, and a judge just in the last week has ruled that one of the major dam projects is allowed to continue. Just physically on the ground, what does it mean, and who are the people who are resisting, and what do they do?
That actually is something that reached fever pitch in the last few weeks in India, because you know, this and the movement against dams is actually a very beautiful political argument, because it combines environmental issues, issues of water, of resources, and of displacement with a political vision for a new kind of society. No political ideology, classic political ideology, has really done that properly. Either it's only environmental or it's only about people. Here, somehow, that's why I got so drawn into it. But this struggle was against the notion of big dams, and it's been a nonviolent struggle for 25 years. But now, the dams are still being built, and the argument has been reduced merely to displacement. And even there, the courts are now saying you build the dam and just give people cash and send them off. But the fact is that these are indigenous people. You know, you can't just give them, lots of them are indigenous people, the others are farmers. But you can't The levels of displacement are so huge. This dam, the Sardarsarovar Dam, displaces 400,000. But just in the Narmada Valley, you're talking about millions of people. All over India, you're talking about many millions who are being displaced. So where are they going to go? Well, the court came out with a judgment which marked a different era in India, where they even stopped pretending that they were interested in resettlement or rehabilitation. They just said, build the dam. So it's very interesting that people were watching this nonviolent movement unfold its weapons on the streets, which is the activists who went on indefinite hunger strike. People paid attention, but then they got kicked in the teeth. Meanwhile, across India, from West Bengal to Orissa to Jharkhand to Chhattisgarh to Andhra Pradesh, the Maoist movement has become very, very strong. It's an armed struggle. It's taking over district after district. The administration cannot get in there. And the government's response to that is to do what was done in Peru with the Shining Path, which is to set up armed defense committees, which is really creating a situation of civil war. You know, hundreds of villages are being emptied by the government, and people are being moved into police camps, people are being armed. The chief minister of Chhattisgarh says, you're either with the Maoists, the Naxalites, or you're with the Salva Judo, which is this government-sponsored resistance, and there's no third choice.
So you're either with
us or against us. And what has happened, which is something I've been saying for a long time, that this whole war on terror and the legislation that has come up around it is going to conflate terrorists with poor people. And that's what's happened. In India, in January, I don't know if you read about it, but it was a terrible thing that happened in Orissa, which is a state where all these corporations have their greedy eyes fixed because they've just discovered huge deposits of bauxite, which you need to make aluminium, which you need to make weapons and planes.
And where is Orissa?
Orissa is sort of east, southeast. And it's got a huge indigenous population. If you go there, it's like a police state. You know, police have surrounded villages. You can't move from one. Villagers are not allowed to move from one village to another to organize because, of course, there's a lot of resistance. The Maoists have come in. And in Orissa, in a place called Kalinganagar, where the Tata, which is used to be a sort of respected industrialist, but now I can't say, are setting up a steel factory. So the government took over the lands of indigenous people. The trick is that you only say about 20% of them are project affected, the rest are all encroachers. Even these 20% are given, their land is taken from them at say 35,000 rupees an acre, given to the Tatas for 3.5 lakhs, you know, which is 10 times that amount. And the actual market price is 4 times that amount. So you steal from the poor, you subsidize the rich, then you call it the free market. And when they protested, there was dynamite, you know, in the ground. Some of them were blown up, killed. Six of them, I think, were injured, taken to hospital, and their bodies were returned with their hands and breasts and things cut off. And those people have been blocking the highway now for 6 months, the indigenous people, because it became a big issue in India. But it's been happening everywhere, and they're all called terrorists. You know, people with bows and arrows are called terrorists. So in India, the poor are the terrorists, and even states like Andhra Pradesh, you have thousands of people being held as political prisoners, called Maoists, held as political prisoners in unknown places without charges or with false charges. We have the highest number of custodial deaths in the world. And we have Thomas Friedman going on and on about how this is an ideal society, a tolerant society. Tens of thousands of people killed in Kashmir, all over the Northeast. You have the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, where a junior non-commissioned officer can shoot at sight. And That is the democracy in which we live.
And the Maoists, what are their demands?
Well, the Maoists are fighting on two fronts. One is that they're fighting a feudal society, where you have feudal landlords, you have, the whole caste system, which is ranged against the indigenous people and the Dalits, who are the untouchable caste. And they are fighting against this whole corporatization. But they're also very poor people, you know, barefoot, with old rusty weapons. And say someone like myself, watching what is happening in Kashmir, where, or in the Northeast, where exactly what America is doing in Iraq, you know, where you're fostering a kind of civil war and then saying, oh, if we pull out, these people just will massacre each other. But the longer you stay, the more you're enforcing these tribal differences and creating a resistance which obviously on the one hand someone like me does support. On the other hand, you support the resistance, but you may not support the vision that they are fighting for. And I keep saying, you know, I'm doomed to fight on the side of people that have no space for me in their social imagination, and I'd probably be the first person that was strung up if they won. But the point is that they are the ones that are resisting on the ground, and they have to be supported because what is happening is unbelievable.
Speaking of Iraq, let me play a clip of President Bush in Chicago Monday, where he addressed a gathering organized by the National Restaurant Association. In his remarks, the president talked about Iraq, which has just formed a new unity government.
For most Iraqis, a free, democratic, and constitutional government will be a new experience. And for the people across the broader Middle East, a free Iraq will be an inspiration. Iraqis have done more than form a government. They have proved that the desire for liberty in the heart of the Middle East is for real. They've shown diverse people can come together and work out their differences and find a way forward. And they've demonstrated that democracy is the hope of the Middle East and the destiny of all mankind. The triumph of liberty in Iraq is part of a long and familiar story. The great biographer of American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, wrote, "Freedom is ordinarily born in the midst of storms. It is established painfully among civil discords. And only when it is old can one know its benefits." Years from now, people will look back on the formation of a unity government in Iraq as a decisive moment in the story of liberty, a moment when freedom gained a firm foothold in the Middle East and the forces of terror began their long retreat.
President Bush in Chicago, Arundhati Roy from India here in New York, your response.
Well, you know, how can one respond? I just keep wishing there would be a laugh track, you know, on the side of these speeches. But obviously, you know, the elections in Palestine, where you had a democratic government, now Palestine's being starved because they have a democracy, under siege because they have a democracy. But in Iraq, this fake business is called democracy. Forget about what's happening in Saudi Arabia. So it's just, you know, I think the issue is that people like President Bush and his advisors, or what's happening in India, the Indian government, they've understood that you can use the media to say anything from minute to minute. It doesn't matter what's really going on. It doesn't matter what happened in the past. There are a few people who make the connections and fall about laughing at the nonsense that is being spoken. But for everybody else, I think the media itself, this mass media, has become a means of telling the most unbelievable lies or making the most unbelievable statements, and everybody sort of just imbibes it. It's like a drug, you know, that you put straight into your veins. It doesn't matter, and it keeps going. But what can you say when What kind of democracy is this in Iraq?
What do you think has to happen in Iraq?
I think that the first thing that has to happen is that the American army should leave. You know, that has to happen. I have no doubt about that. Similarly, I mean, I keep saying this, but, you know, in America, Israel, and India, and China and Tibet are now becoming experts in occupation. And India is one of the leading experts. You know, it's not that the American army in its training exercises teaching the Indian army. The Indians are teaching the Americans to how to occupy a place. What do you do with the media? How do you deal with it? The occupation of Kashmir has taken place over years. And I keep saying that in Iraq, you have 125,000 or so American troops in a situation of war, controlling 25 million Iraqis. In Kashmir, you have 700,000 Indian troops, fully armed there, you know, and creating a situation, making it worse and worse and worse. So the first thing that has to happen is that the army has to come out, you know.
We're speaking to Arundhati Roy, who has spent time in Kashmir, lives in Delhi, the acclaimed author and activist. We'll continue with her after this break. Kuteri, sung by the Women's Collective of Gujarat. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In June of 2005, a World Tribunal on Iraq was held in Istanbul, Turkey. A 17-member jury of conscience at the tribunal heard testimonies from a panel of advocates and witnesses who came from across the world. Arundhati Roy was selected as the chair of that jury. She's in our studio today, but let's watch her in Istanbul, hear what she has to say.
To ask us why we're doing this, you know, why is there a world tribunal on Iraq? It's like asking, you know, someone who stops at the site of an accident where people are dying on the road, why did you stop? Why didn't you keep walking like everybody else? While I listened to the testimonies yesterday especially, I must say that I didn't know, I mean, not that one has to choose, but still, you know, I didn't know what was more chilling, you know, the testimonies of those who came from Iraq with the stories of the blood and the destruction and the brutality and the darkness of what was happening there, or the stories of that cold, calculated world where the business contracts are being made, where the laws are being
rewritten, where a country occupies another with no idea of how it's going to provide protection to people, but with such a sophisticated idea of how it's going to loot it of its resources. It, you know, the brutality or the contrast of those two things was so chilling. You know, there were times when I felt I wish I wasn't on the jury because I want to say things. You know, I mean, and I think that is the nature of this tribunal, that in a way one wants to be everything. You want to be on the jury. You want to be on the other side. You want to say things. And I particularly wanted to talk a lot about, which I won't do now, so don't worry, but I wanted to talk a lot about my own, you know, now several years of experience with issues of resistance, strategies of resistance, the fact that we actually tend to reach for easy justifications of violence and nonviolence, easy and not really very accurate historical examples. These are things we should worry about. But at the end of it, today we do seem to live in a world where the United States of America has defined an enemy combatant, someone who they can kidnap from any country, from any place in the world, and take for trial to America. An enemy combatant seems to be anybody who harbors thoughts of resistance. Well, if this is the definition, then I, for one, am an enemy combatant.
Arundhati Roy speaking at the World Tribunal Iraq, head of the jury there, the jury of conscience, in June of 2005. Your thoughts almost a year later right now. Arundhati Roy as enemy combatant?
Yes, I guess, you know, I think one of the things that that I worry about is that there is a way in which, say, somebody like me can also be used by the other side. You know, I know, I'm very aware of the fact that in India, you know, they kind of leak the political meaning out of things and then say, oh, we have this great batsman, cricket batsman, Sachin Tendulkar, and we have Miss Universe, Aishwarya Rai, and we have this writer, Arundhati Roy, and you know, everything is telescoped as a kind of look at all the things that we have on display, and we are a democracy, so we allow her to say these things, you know, and go on with it. And yet, these democracies have learned to just stare things down, you know? So even in America, eventually all of us who are protesting or writing or whatever, we can be commodified. You know, it can just turn into something that we're doing, and yet they carry on doing what they're doing, we carry on doing what we're doing. But ultimately, people are being displaced, countries are being occupied, people are being killed, laws are being changed, and the status quo is on their side, not on our side. You know, so I worry about that a lot, you know.
I remember when you were last here, you were headed off to an interview with Charlie Rose. And so I looked to see you on Charlie Rose, and I waited and I waited and I never saw you. What happened?
Oh, it was interesting. He, well, when the interview began, I realized that, you know, the plan was to do this really aggressive interview with me. And so the first question he asked was, tell me, Arundhati, do you think that India should have nuclear weapons? So I said, I don't think India should have nuclear weapons. I don't think the US should have nuclear weapons. I don't think Israel should have nuclear weapons. I don't think anyone should have nuclear weapons. It's something that I've written a lot about. He said, I asked you whether India should have nuclear weapons. So I said, well, I don't think India should have nuclear weapons. I don't think the US should have nuclear weapons. I don't think Israel should have nuclear weapons. Then he said, will you answer my question? Should India have nuclear weapons? So I said, I don't think India should have nuclear weapons. I don't think the US should have nuclear weapons. I don't think Israel should have nuclear weapons.
Then I asked him, I said, what is this about? Why are you being so aggressive? I've answered the question, you know, clearly. I think I made my position extremely clear. I'm not some strategic thinker. I'm telling you what I believe. So it sort of, after that, it just sort of collapsed into vague questions about world poverty and so on, and it was never shown. I mean, I wouldn't have shown it if I were him either, but because it was, I don't know, treating me like I'm some kind of politician or something.
Has he invited you back on in this new trip that you've had?
No, I don't think.
Have you found that through your celebrity, through your writing, that you're invited into forum, into various places, where when you talk about what you think, you're then shut down?
No, I think what happens is that, I don't come to, the U.S. that often, and like for instance, this time I came to do, you know, an event with Eduardo Galeano, but I really wasn't, I didn't want to do any, except for this, I made it clear that I don't want to be working on this trip because I want to think about some things. But I think it's the opposite problem that I have. I think that there are many ways of shutting people down, you know, and one is to increase the burners on this celebrity thing till you become so celebrity that all you are is celebrity. You know, so for example, I'll give you a wonderful example of how it works, say in India. I was at a meeting in Delhi a few months ago, the Association of Parents for Disappeared People. Now, women had come down from Kashmir. There are 10,000 or so disappeared people in Kashmir, which nobody talks about in the mainstream media at all. Here were these women whose mothers or brothers or sons or husbands had, sorry, not mothers, but whatever, all these people who were speaking of their personal experiences, and there were other speakers, and there was me. In the next day, in this, more or less right-wing paper called Indian Express, there was a big picture of me, really close, so that you couldn't see the context. You couldn't see who had organized the meeting or what it was about, nothing. And underneath it said, Arundhati Roy at the International Day of the Disappeared. So you have the news, but it says nothing, you know? That's the kind of thing that can happen, where actually, I'm somebody who is invited to mainstream forums, and I'm not shut down. You know, I can say what I have to say. But the point is, Amy, that there's a delicate line between just being so far, just being so isolated that you become the spokesperson for everything, and this kind of person that it suits them to have one person who's saying something and listen to it and ignore what is being said. And I don't want to move so far away from everybody else that, you know, if you want to listen to me, then why don't you listen to so-and-so? Why don't you speak to so-and-so? Why don't you get some other voices? Because otherwise it sounds like you're this lone, brave, amazing person, which is unpolitical.
Arundhati Roy, I'm just looking at a KMS Newswire story, that's Kashmir Media Service, mm-hmm. May 23rd, just after you spoke here in New York. It says, a human rights activist and prominent Indian writer Arundhati Roy has said India is not a democratic state. The 1997 Booker winner Arundhati Roy, addressing a book reading function in New York, said India is not a democratic society. Can you talk about that idea?
Well, I do think that we are really suffering a crisis of democracy, you know? And the simplest way I can explain it is that in 2004, when the general elections took place in India, we were reeling from 5 years of right-wing communal BJP, politics, the right-wing Hindu party.
Would you make any parallels to political parties in the United States?
Very, very much so. I mean, it was very similar to the Republicans versus the Democrats. And in fact,
the Congress Party being the
Democrats. Congress Party being the Democrats and the you know, Republicans being the right-wing Hindu BJP. And of course, in a country like in America, their politics, apart from affecting Americans to a great deal, also affects the rest of the world. But in India, you know, India not being a world power, however much it wants to claim it is, turns those energies on its own people. So in Gujarat, you had in 2002 this mass killing of Muslims on the streets, a bloodbath where people were burnt alive, women were raped on the streets, dismembered, killed, in full public view. What happened after that? There were elections, and the man who engineered all this won the elections. So you're thinking, is it better to have a fascist dictator or a fascist Democrat who has the approbation of all these people, continues to be in power in Gujarat? Nothing has happened. It's a Nazi type of society where hundreds of thousands of people are still economically boycotted Muslims. Something like 100,000 driven from their homes. Police won't register cases. One or two important cases are looked at by the Supreme Court, but the mass of it is still completely unresolved. That's the situation. Anyway, and while you're orchestrating this communal killing, you're also selling off to Enron and to all these private companies. And so on the one hand, you're talking about Indianness and all this in this nationalism in this absurd way. And on the other, you're just selling it off in bulk. But during the elections, all of us were waiting with bated breath to see what would happen. And when the Congress came to power, supported by the left parties from the outside, obviously, we allowed ourselves a huge gasp of relief, you know, walked on our hands in front of the TV for a bit. But the Congress campaigned against the neoliberal policies that it had brought in, actually. But before even we knew whether Sonia Gandhi was going to be the president, prime minister, or what was going to happen, there was an orchestrated drop in the stock market. The media's own stocks began to drop. The cameras that had been in all these villages saying, look at this wonderful democracy and the camels and the bullock carts and everyone's coming to vote, was outside the stock market now. And before the government was formed, both from the left and from the Congress, spokesmen had to come out and say, we will not dismantle this neoliberal regime. And today we have a prime minister who's not been elected. He's a technocrat who's been nominated. He's part of the Washington consensus.
I want to ask in our last 30 seconds the role you see of the artist in a time of war.
Well, I think the problem is that artists are not a homogenous lot of people, and some of them are as right-wing and establishment as they can get. You know, so the role of the artist is not different from the role of any human being who's on. You pick your side and then you fight. You know, but in a country like India, I'm not seeing that many radical positions taken by writers or poets or artists. You know, it's all the seduction of the market that has shut them up like a good medieval beheading never could, you know.
And what you think artists should do?
Exactly what anyone else should do, which is to pick your side, take your position, and then go for it, you know.
Arundhati Roy, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things, as well as a number of books of political essays like The Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire. That does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Abdel Kadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are engineers. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!